Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Ashdown Engineering, a British bass amplification powerhouse whose gear is seen on the biggest stages in the world, backing up the biggest bands in the world. But now Ashdown have expanded their expertise into bass guitars. Having teamed up with Master Luthier Dan Lackin, previously of Lackland Basses, Ashdown are now offering 5 different models of US-designed basses, from classically inspired shapes to completely new designs, fusing vintage sensibilities with all the modern applications a bassist needs. Available in an ever-expanding range of finishes, and all for under £1,000. These instruments are extremely exciting. Check them out at ashdownmusic.com or follow links in the description of this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, a podcast by guitar nerds, all about bass. I'm your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by JD Short.
Hello.
And Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, everyone. And we're back. We're back with the fourth episode in this series. We're going to do something in this episode, I think, that we don't normally do on the main episode, or at least I claim I'm going to do every now and again and never get around to it. We're actually going to focus on a load of questions from the group, which will be good. You know, there's not much news going on, really. At the moment, you know, not too many things are being released, and of course we're only interested in the bass things that are being released. But yes, I guess first of all, how is everyone doing? How's everyone's bass playing weeks been going? JD,
it's been going quite well. Been listening to the new Deftones single a lot and really enjoying it in a way that I do every few Deftones albums, where I'm just like, this is fantastic. So I've been noodling around with that quite a bit. Also dug out some of my just sort of tutorial books that I kind of go back to, and just sort of, you know, old friends play through, you know, work on sight reading and stuff. So it's been good. It's been a nice comforting revisit.
I don't know very much about Deftones, obviously, other than the Stephen Carpenter baritone 7-string that comes in some incredible finishes. I mean, that guitar is absolutely outstanding. It seems that every signature model he's had has been fantastic. But not knowing that much about Deftones, what on earth does their bass player play in order to compete with a 7-string baritone?
A P bass through an SVT.
Oh, really?
No, I'm not actually sure, because I'm mostly familiar with a lot of their earlier works when they had a different bass player who is now sadly passed. And, you know, a lot of his stuff, like, I think early I'm trying to remember from, like, seeing or playing shows, like, way, way back. But, like, I think he used to play like a Music Man, and I'm pretty sure it was SVTs, or, you know, this was probably mid 90s, so it could have been Trace Elliott. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Music Man, SVT, or Mesa, something, you know, one of the 400 plus one of those heads or something.
Yeah. The Stingray did seem to have its, like, those sorts of bands were like, that was the Music Man's calling. And it definitely had, if you think about when the Deftones started, I guess, you know, well, it's not similar bands, you know, when you think of people like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and bands like that, where Music Man Stingrays were kind of the instrument of choice. That does seem to be, I think of that era as being like, that's when that big eight pole pickup on the bridge was the right sort of thing for bass.
Yeah, and the Seymour Duncan quarter pounders everywhere, and like, seeing those sort of,
everyone changed their P basses for Seymour Duncan quarter pounders, myself included. It's a pickup that I still have fitted in my Mexican 50s P bass, and it's only there because I haven't changed it. Like, I don't really like it, and I think I've benched that bass for the best part of the last, you know, probably decade. And haven't really played it, and it's a great bass. Like, I've had it refinished in a lovely two-tone Sunburst Nitro. It's really nice. It's just that quarter pounder is a little bit, it feels like I'm constantly sort of collapsing the input gain on whatever amp. It kind of removes any headroom that I would have from on a clean tone.
Yeah.
They're a bit too much.
They're a bit all or nothing, and I feel like a lot of people have kind of had their moment maybe with quarter pounders, and not everyone has, you know, not everyone's love affair with them has continued beyond the initial hype, I suppose, of I'm going to fit quarter pounders. It's going to sound meaty AF, right?
Yeah. Well, that was it, wasn't it? It was like they were the biggest, it was the biggest pole pieces. It was like, I guess at that time, because I think Mark Hoppus from Blink-182 had quarter pounders, and I guess Tom DeLonge had his Seymour Duncan Invaders in Invader humbucker in his Strat at the time. And that was kind of the order of the day. Everyone was like, what is the loudest pickup I can fit into my instrument? And I guess Seymour Duncan really sort of nailed that. I think today everyone's, I don't know, because I'm only really into sort of vintage stuff, but I feel like low output pickups are you know, more popular now. The versatility with that is kind of a more popular route. I'm not 100% sure.
I agree with you there, and I think, I mean, my hunch is that a lot of it has to do with it, like, there actually being input gain preamps on a lot of bass amps now, where there used to just be, it used to just be master volume, and you had the active passive input, which is just a pad. And so having a high output or low output, you know, it made more of a difference, where now you have like an input gain on a lot of the bass amps.
Yeah.
Just quickly, I did a tiny bit of Googling, and Joe, you're sitting down now, right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Sergio Vega, the new bass player for Deftones, he's been the bass player for a while. Doesn't like to play five or six string basses. He will play a Fender Bake 6, but he has a Whammy modified Jaguar bass that he plays in drop D, drop C sharp. I just wanted to chuck that out there, because somehow we got to a place where this sounds perfect for us.
That sounds absolutely ridiculous. Who even makes whammies for bass, for four string basses? You had one on.
Yeah, I had one, and so Kaler makes them primarily. Hipshot also does one, or has done on and off. The one I had was machined from a guy that did it one off in Canada. But yeah, like Kaler's probably who you're going to go. Kaler, Hipshot, I think. I'm pretty sure Hipshot still does one, or they have done it some.
Yeah, they do. I'm looking at it here. Four string bass tremolo and a five string.
Oof.
For all of your low B bending needs.
Or high C.
or high C.
Yeah.
My apologies to high C tuners out there.
I could really get into that, I think, if I was going to add a string. A high C rather than a low B. I can see more of a use for that.
I'm really thinking about doing it. The only five string I have now is, it's been low B for ages, but I never, I never really play that way. And again, like, I always play sort of mid position anyway, so I'm usually above fifth fret, so it was just a nice easy way to hit some of those notes without like going all the way down or anything like that. So it was a way to play across the fingerboard.
Yeah.
More for so your fretting than, like, hand as well. It's that bit less stretch, right?
Yeah. And, but yeah, like so much of the stuff I do is sort of, it's not necessarily higher register stuff, but it's, I would like to do that in a more chordal way lower down, as opposed to having to play everything like up high, because just the way the timbre is when you, you know, play an A at the 12th fret of your A string versus, you know, like 7th fret of a D string, you know, like it's one of those, like,
of course,
it sounds different, and I would like to sort of be able to do that kind of stuff. I just, you know, it's an option, so it's something I've been thinking about for quite a while, and I have strings to do it. I haven't actually done it.
What bass is it that you have that's 5-string?
That is the Reed Custom Instruments bass. I have that bespoke one that I designed.
I remember that.
Yeah. Like ages ago, with like basically every option I could think of ever wanting or needing on a bass.
So. Stonefield also do 5 strings with either way, don't they? It can be a low B or a high C.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I would think about doing a 5-string high C. I think that'd be interesting.
Naomi, you have a 5-string Reverend, right?
I do indeed. Yeah,
yours is low B, is it?
It is. Yeah, there was one or two highly experimental tunings I tried, which would almost sit in between what we're talking about. I brought everything up a full step previously, so that would be C sharp, F sharp, B, E, and A.
Oh, that sounds cool. That sounds more usable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, usable until you need to learn someone else's song. But for riffing around it was yeah, it felt really nice. I mean, one thing I suppose that I always fall into anytime I play a guitar, not that it's that frequently, is I use a capo. I love to kind of see how much the instrument can change, and like you're saying, JD, just how much the timbre can change with positioning chords on the neck and stuff. So I suppose every so often I'll do similar temporary experiments with the bass, and this was a particularly nice one on the 5-string.
And wait, what strings do you use?
Currently on the 5-string, it's funny you ask. I'm trying to make the move away from having just about all my basses strung with flats. I think
Well, do you have flats even on the 5-string?
I do indeed, yeah. I have
That's very cool.
Yeah. What are they on it? I think they're just Labella Deep Talking. But yeah, so basically I was on a gig for quite a while playing funk and soul and Motown kind of stuff, and because of some transpositions that we did for the singers that we were working with, a 5-string bass just kind of made sense for quite a lot of stuff that was in E flat. And then some of the more modern tunes, just having the low B to riff around with some octave work was nice. So yeah, the Mercalli was a perfect gig for that kind of vintage woofy full kind of voicing.
Yeah, I bet. Ernie Ball have just released a set of flats, and their whole marketing for them is like, I don't think they're doing it for fives, but their whole marketing strategy is like, these are flat wound strings that sound like round wounds.
Oh,
which
I think see.
It's kind of, it's a weird place to sort of set your sights, but
it is. I'm curious, would they sound anything like the half rounds?
No, yeah. Maybe. For me, I was kind of like, well, I definitely, because my love of flats is definitely more to do with my love of the Rolling Stones than it is me actually liking flats. Like I go through phases, like I'll string everything up with flats, play it with polymath for a while, and then I'll just be like, this really doesn't work for a big, aggressive, drivey band. And I'll change back to rounds and I'll be like, yeah, this sounds much better. And then a few months will pass. I'll listen to a load of like Neil Young and Rolling Stones again. And then I'll be like, yeah, I'm going to change everything to flats. And I'm in this constant cycle. So kind of the idea of having something that feels like flats but sounds more like rounds, I think is kind of attractive for me.
Definitely. And also just how it feels as well. I mean, for me, the transition to flats came alongside trying to learn what I felt like was very late in the day to begin to play fingerstyle versus having played heavier music with a pick for many years.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously flats against fingerstyle is, well, at least personally, that a good bit more comfortable.
Yeah.
Than trying to play some of Jamerson's busier lines on rounds. So it's I'm a bit like yourself though, Joe. I definitely seem to swing from stringing everything with flats to stringing everything with rounds. Have you ever tried any of the in between, like the ground wound or the half wounds?
The half wounds I haven't. I started using this string. This string type from Newtone. Have either of you ever used Newtone strings? I haven't. So I really like Newtone strings. They're like a custom shop, and you can have your own strings made. And I'm going to have to kind of quickly go onto the website as we talk about it to see if because he gave me Neil, who owns the company, gave me some of this experimental set of strings, which are kind of like an old set of rounds. Is the deal. So they sound super dead, but they feel kind of like rounds. They've definitely more aggression than flats, but and I'm one of those people that, like, oh, once my strings get to my round wounds get to being a year old on a bass, I'm like, that's where I'm happy. That's when the tone is where I want it to be.
Yeah.
And this gave me that instantly. But the great thing about their strings is that you can because you can custom order, that helped me, because half the time Polymath are playing in new standard tuning, which is like King Crimson's tuning, which is all fourths basically. So it's C, G, D, A. So I have to have heavy gauge strings for those first three. But of course, to get up to an A on the high string, I have to have something very thin. So it's handy to be able to order those sort of custom sets.
Cool. All fifths, do you mean?
Mm. Depends on which way you're going.
Fifths. Yes. I guess it's all fifths, yeah.
Awesome. Circle of fifths, just like Mr. Bach himself. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I've listened to Polymath plenty and even seen you play, but I didn't actually cop that was the tuning. That's awesome. So I'm guessing chordal work is that bit more comfortable than if you're able to kind of play in parallels?
It makes we did it because we ran out of ideas, and I think changing tuning is a fantastic way to do exactly the same things with your left hand and get completely different results. Yeah. And new standard is one of those tunings that works really well. As in, you do all those movements that are quite familiar to you with your left hand, and they will all still work. They won't sound wrong, but they will sound very different. So,
awesome.
And they have a really specific sound. The problem with new standard is it kind of has one sound.
I get you. Kind of modal, right?
Because So it's why we always have to have a couple of guitars, because, of course, you can't just tune into new standard because it needs a different set of strings.
Sure. Okay. So there you get your custom sets. Okay.
Exactly. But it means we have to change guitars like mid gig, which I always think makes us look like pretentious. When a bass player changes bass mid gig, it's just like, oh, what are you doing, mate? But I have to do that all the time. It's terrible.
I feel very attacked.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know about you, JD, but it's a perfectly normal action to take for those of us who, like yourself, care about how we sound.
I mean, I do it, every gig. I just always feel bad about it. It's
I get you. I remember I used to on my little TC Ditto. I used to have these really like elaborate loops that I'd flick on for like what I, in my overthinking way, thought would be the most uncomfortable silence for the watching audience as I change bass. And it's like, people just go and get a pint. It's fine. It's just a little gig. No biggie. I'm on the Newtone site here. It's awesome. You can configure so much.
Oh, they're so good.
Tenor guitar strings. custom bass string configurators right there on the main page.
I can't recommend this company enough. Like the strings are very, very good from Newtone, and they've made me like custom sets of bass six strings, because when I got my bass six, I was like, I love this, but I want to play it in polymath, which means I can't have it in standard tuning. You know, even if I didn't put it in new standard, it would have to be in D standard at least. And so trying to get a baritone style guitar stroke bass a step down when bass sixes, strings on bass sixes are already really floppy, because that low E is normally only a 90 on a standard set of bass six strings. And that's not like, you know, if you put that on a four string bass, that's just going to be hanging off the instrument. And it was always an effort, but the Newtone strings, you know, made me a set where it went up to like 118 was the thickest we could make it, and it not be touching the next string, you know. But
I'm really into this. Like I've been looking for kind of a new string company to try. I mean, I say that, and I also probably have enough like just raw strings to make an automobile, like, and but also just like trying, because I've played DR strings for years and years and years and years, and then Labella is sort of my other and then some like Diodaros, depending, like I use Diodaros for my upright and things usually, but I'm really interested in like sort of just new flavors of strings that are out there, in that I, you know, certainly for bass, I see this all the time too, certainly with like shockingly extended range instruments and things, but there's so many new companies. Like this feels like a new frontier of like innovation at the moment.
Really cool. For sure. And this company are always expanding. There always seems to be like new strings that they're trialing and adding to their list, and I love the choice of cores are quite substantial with them as well, so there's kind of something for everyone. And it looks like you get 10% off if you subscribe to their mailing list as well, off your first order. So, you know, listener, if you are looking for something, you know, we've spoken about them on in the past on the Guitar Nerds podcast, but they are absolutely fantastic. And Newtone strings, I was actually speaking to them recently, and they were saying that, you know, they are at the moment they're so much more popular for bass guitarists. You know, they're really starting to take off with bassists as opposed to sort of guitars, which I think was their bread and butter initially.
Sure.
But I think you know, bass players, we all want our own, you know, our own specific set specifically for us, don't we? So it's, I think guitarists are quite happy to, you know, wang a set of tens on or whatever.
Well, I mean, it's also like they're a fiver half the time, right? You know, so it's like, well, who really cares? Where it's like, it's 10 quid, 50, you know, it's like I've shelled out close to 100 US on strings before, you know, like the Thomas Infelds or like something like that, where you're just like, okay, that's 80 US plus shipping plus, you know, or something. And it's like, it's a different level of investment than, I don't know, the pink pack, you know, then.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah. And I think even if you look at the boring fundamental supply chain end, it's like there simply aren't as many models of bass string out there as nearly as there are guitar. Like looking at Newtone here, like I mean, they're obviously a smaller scale company than the Daidarios and the Labellas that we hear a lot about as well. But I mean, just even the layout of the site is like a bassist dream. Like first up to eighth string, what gauge you'd like is I wish more companies would do things this way. It's really awesome.
Yeah, it's really good. On strings being loads of money, recently when I got a set of Labella deep talking bass strings for the first time, which are about £50, they're really, really good, but someone had also told me about had been talking to me about Tomastix. And just how good they were, and I was like, oh, they're £5 more than the Labellas. I can't make a decision. I'll have to get both, which, you know, yeah. is then like, today I spent £110 on two sets of strings, one of which I'm probably not going to use. Well, you know, not going to initially use because I'll prefer the others.
It feels like boring money, but obviously it's so so crucial to our playing, to literally every aspect of our playing and our sound, right?
Yeah.
I think with bass too, one, just physics involved, like there's much more energy, so like all this stuff means more. But like I found, like every time I get a new bass, it's like sort of going through a process to figure out exactly which string sounds the best for it, right? And that's one of the reasons I started exploring, because I had played DRs exclusively, like different sets of DR, but DR exclusively since like 95 or so, up until five six years ago, when I got that Fender Jazz bass I think we mentioned or something. And so I was playing Fender Jazz, and I was just really trying to find, like, it just didn't sound, I knew it could sound better, like I knew there was something lacking, and so it was just like, all right, let's try different strings, let's go, like, that's, you know, it's like trying D'Addario, trying like Labella, which I've always really liked, trying, you know, like exposed core, seeing if there can be anything else like that. Like,
sure. I don't know anything about DRs. Like, I know, you know, I obviously know what the logo looks like, but I don't think I've ever strung a set of DRs.
They're superb.
I love them so much. Like, the reason I got hooked on them was one of the bands I was in at the time is, there was one song I used to do that I did like two-handed tapping, where my right hand, like I played with a slide, and it was like a metal slide. So it was like tapping. So it was cool. Right. It sounded like a scratching, because DJs were the rage then. And, but doing that, we always opened this set with that song, and like it shredded my G string every time. And so like you could see like the fret indent in the bottom half of the G. So if there's ever like humidity change, or I had to like twist a string up, like it would like phase out on like it would just like insane fret right on like the E on the G string, which was useful, you know. and so I was like, okay, so I ended up changing strings after every gig, which, as we just discussed, is expensive. And then luckily I was in a band that was doing okay, so fine. I got DR strings, and then they were the first ones that allowed me to be able to just swap just change one string and it still sound correct with the rest of the set. And then so I started doing that, and then they're really great. And I played them like all the different variants, like the low riders and high beams and stuff. But yeah, like they're really, I guess how I would assume is like they're like dry and kind of raw sounding, but also like this, like they're very warm and rich, but there's just like a realness to them. Like it's like an exposed string. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a more attacky sounding string, was something I always found using DRs.
Really?
Like I used Black Beauties for a long time, which are coated stainless steel, if I remember correctly. And the tone was just markedly kind of more transient, more out there, still big sounding strings, like you said, JD, but just more, I guess, more aggressive on balance.
Yeah, like lots of high mid, that sort of sparkly trebly, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I really pushed them and used them to kind of get the most out of the distorted sort of Aguilar aggro sort of tone that I was using at the time, and I found them perfect for that.
And the high beams are the ones that I hear of a lot. Mm. I assume those are the ones that are supposed to be very bright, right? I guess that's what that.
See, I never really found them to be. I mean, this could just be me and, you know, the rest of my settings and playings, but like I never really found them to be super, super, like they weren't zingy like you would get with like boomers, or even like a lot of the D'Addarios I would find, or like the Ernie Ball strings that always felt like they had much more sizzle. Like I think that's the, when you get like in the really, really high upper ends, like there's that sizzliness, which I don't really use or like so much, same as like, you know, like do you turn your tweeter off on your 410, you know, kind of thing. But then, yeah, like the DRs, they would go like really, it almost, I'm making this up, but it's like, it almost looks like if you would just see like they, it looks like they would go really high. And then at the point where it would become like harsh, they stop, you know, so they can have that like attack, and there's the drive and everything up top. But then you don't have that like, oh, that's really clangy. Like they never got clangy, even when they would like, they did like a really nice slow death, I think. Whereas like some strings, like for me, especially like some of the ones I had played, like if the way I play, like if they weren't brand new or if they weren't like old, that like those awkward teenage years were a very long time. Like it was just like, ugh, this is like, there's like weird mid-range honk, you know,
right.
And you're like,
yeah, I know what you mean.
Sound like a goose, you know, and I was like, that's not what I want.
So. But that's exactly the sound I want. I want all the mid-range. Yeah. I got really into tape wounds a while ago.
I had one of those. I lost a lot of weight. Hey.
Wow.
Oh, wow, that was good. That's an excellent dad joke. And of course, why not? This is a bass podcast. But yeah, I got really into tape rounds recently. Well, you know, a while ago when I discovered, you know, that you could have this, have a string with kind of it. Well, you know, it was off the back of there's a famous for me rig rundown with Juan Alderete in like a bathroom on the last on Premier Guitar, and it was the last Mars Volta tour, I think, or the last record. So they were playing their album Nocturnicut, which was this when they put that record out. Omar Rodriguez Lopez was obsessed with the idea of them being like a portable band. I mean, that could have been budget related as well, but he wanted them to not have all the grandeur and the massive amounts of equipment that they'd had before. So, you know, Juan Alderete, you know, this legendary bass player, was playing through those digital Ampeg flip tops. What were they called?
Not the Portaflex.
Portaflex, yeah, that was it. Yeah.
He
was playing through, he had two of those with two 410s. That was his rig. This guy had gone from being like two full vintage SVTs, was playing through Portaflexes, because the idea was they were portable. But he still had his big pedal board, and around that time, and for the whole of that record, he played this old 60s, I can't remember, I think it was a 62 jazz bass that he had, this black 62 jazz bass that he had strung with tape wounds, and it just sounded incredible. And he spoke about how he used to play them with a plectrum, but had to be really light-handed because the strings are so low tension that you hit them too hard and you kind of lose the note a bit, you know, it scoops the note too much. So you have to play softly, but you need to use a plectrum to get the attack there in the first place. But then you get this gorgeous like Motown sound. And I interviewed Juan Alderete a few years later and asked him about that sound and that record. He said at the time, him and D'Anthony Parks, who was the drummer for the last record, were at the time really into Stax Records, and they were really trying to create a real sort of like Stax-y, Motown-y backing for the rest of the band. That was kind of their whole thing, to lock in with that sort of sound. But I went off on a right tangent there. But for me, there's like, that was like, I was like, right, tape rounds, that sounds like the solution. They're very cool. Have either of you ever delved into tape wounds?
I've played basses with tape wounds. I've not had a set on a bass just yet. In fact, the Chowney that we talked about a few episodes back.
Oh yeah.
The spare set that came along with that little bass are our tape wounds. So next episode I'll be able to report back.
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah, my experience of them has just been that they are really a different beast that does require different playing, but I think the tonal results can be absolutely amazing from them.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah, like when I played them, it was on, again, an old someone's very pleasant 70s P, and they just had that almost like, I don't know, like almost actually double bass sounding kind of woofy warmth. Yeah, very, very different to any kind of metallic string tone that we'd be more used to, even with the tone rolled off.
Yeah, 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 that's exactly it. They're just, yeah, totally, totally their own thing.
The only bass I ever had tape ones on was my 4-string Carvin with a whammy on it.
So. Of course, JD. Yeah. Of course.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Yeah, and they were great. They were like a labella set, but they were wound with. They have a few different ones that have different patterns on it, so they look like a diamondback, snake on up. So it was this really complicated wound, and I was just like this. Yeah, it was seven levels of bonkers in that that bass itself already was just a jazz bass configuration, but sounded just so like raw anyway, because it had the like those Nordstrand warm and woolly big blades and everything, and it was all mahogany with an ebony board, and it was just like it already sounded so different from how it looked anyway. And it was and then like to put tape wounds on it and be like, and then why is there a whammy bar here, like
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I originally started talking about strings to go on to another point, but we're so far into the podcast now, and we said we'd do questions, that if I go on to the point that I was going to make, we'll never do the questions. So I'll have to...
Or we will, but it'll be tomorrow in today's time.
Exactly. So we'll do some questions. We'll take a look. Some questions from the group. And first up, Aaron Sherman. Aaron Sherman asked, what's your favorite bass tone and why is it a P bass into an SVT? Right. his point being, how can I approach the amp side of that equation at less than 300 all valve watts? He says, by the way, I'm not asking what everyone's favorite bass tone is, because it's clearly a P bass into an SVT. Well, yes, the P bass into an SVT is an absolutely sort of quintessential classic tone. This is the tone of bass. The ultimate, the sort of the holy grail of tone is very much a P bass into an SVT. It's what everyone wants. But of course, not everyone wants a two person lift, these days, quite breaky. Yeah. Ampeg SVT.
Some of us value our lower vertebrae.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, you know, it's not like any of us are going to be gigging anytime soon. Why would you want that? You know, so the P-bass thing, obviously, we can all, anyone can get something with a split P pickup or get a similar tone, but it's how to create, it's how to replicate. Now, he's not said, like, how to replicate it affordably,
mm-hmm.
but I guess that is something to take into consideration, you know, because at less than 300 watts, so I guess maybe we're talking about, what do you think we're talking about? Like home level, practice level, or just not the two-person lift amplifier?
I mean, I think it's, well, one, I have a side point that I'll say that it's like, because I often get people ask me, like, if a 100-watt amp is giggable, and I say, is it louder than a human voice? Because, you know, like, assuming you can gig with a human voice, you can mic up whatever else you're gigging with.
Yeah, sure.
Potentially, also, clearly, that shows that I feel it's like a weird privilege thing of being like, I play places with PAs, you know, but like, but yeah, I mean, and
it's
also,
it's an interesting point, though.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. Like, it's one of those things where people are like, oh, yeah, but can you gig with it? And I was like, well, I don't, is it louder than a human voice? If so, then yes. You know, like, mm-hmm. can you gig with it without a microphone? Maybe not. Can you gig with it without going direct? Probably not. You know, but I think, like, so tone wise, and I just want to caveat this first in that, like, I really want to like SVT tones as like the main, as sort of the default, and I sort of recognize that, like, academically, that that's the default tone, but it's. The only SVTs I've ever played that I've really actually liked, that being said, I had two Ampeg 810s, but like the heads, the only ones I've ever really liked were like actual late 60s, early 70s SVT heads. Like I haven't
pre-master volume ones.
Yeah. Like I think there's something about the mid-range in one, that's why it works well in a band. And a lot of times I don't necessarily need that same sort of tone, but there's something about the mid-range, certainly of like the modern ones, that I've never really been able to adequately EQ out, that I don't like. Like, there's something, and I played SVT, I had an SVT for years before I sort of went back to Eden stuff, and it was just, I could never really get it right. And when I have like backline, which is always SVT, or, you know, a GK, Gallian Kruger, that it's the GKs I like quite a bit. Actually, that may be a good shout. But yeah, like I just can't get used to it. And just make one more point quickly, though I know I've talked a bunch, is the what I really like is the B15, like that Portaflex, even like some small amp that does the SVT sound, gets that breakup, gets that it can get that sound, but not in the size of a refrigerator with a microwave on top of it, you know, like B15 is one of my only amp regrets that we can get to in another episode.
Oh yeah, we should talk about. We could definitely talk about B15. I could talk about B15s for a whole episode. They are absolutely wonderful. But
and
yes,
I could too. So maybe we should.
What?
It was, yeah, literally as you said that, JD. That was going to be my shout as well. And even just the more modern Portaflex 15-inch setups to a lesser degree as well. Obviously, haven't quite replicated the B15 faithfully, but. Yeah, the voicing of the PF heads with 15-inch cab are not to be messed with for an homage to the SVT tone, I think.
No, yeah, they were definitely really good. And I guess, okay, so is that the angle that we're going for? Like, what smaller, are we talking about like what digital or solid state amplifiers can achieve that without a two-man lift?
I mean, I would have said even something like a smaller tube head, like even the PF20, is kind of that more like compactified I suppose effort at the tube tone before we get into the likes of, you know, our Aguilar, Quilter, Eden type kind of fully solid state heads.
Aguilar seemed to be that brand for me that I think took a crack at this more mm-hmm. than anyone else from a digital mm-hmm. standpoint. When they came out, it was kind of like when the first Aguilars came out, it was you had the like Mark base, I feel, were dominating that sort of area. And mm-hmm. for, like around that time, I guess I was working in the bass department in GAC. And I guess if people came in and they want, because at that time, like, you know, Ampeg were done in all but, you know, name. Yeah. They really weren't making great stuff. And so if someone came in and said they wanted a traditional sounding bass amplifier, I'd sell them an Ashdown. If someone came in and said they wanted a modern sounding bass amplifier, I'd sell them a Mark bass. And that was kind of how it went. If someone said they wanted a cheap bass amplifier, I'd sell them a TC Electronic. But it didn't really vary outside of that demographic very much. And when Aguilar came out, they seemed like they managed to do what Ashdown and Mark bass were doing very well all in one mm-hmm. by making mm-hmm. lightweight, portable digital amp heads. But they, you know, they looked very classic. They sounded very classic. They kind of did away with that need for people were buying Class D amps and then Sans amps in order to mm-hmm. create vintage tones. That
Which
was sort
is
of
also the answer there.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. That's a setup. Yeah.
I mean, a Sans amp, certainly the... Which one do you guys use? If I assume everyone uses or has used a Sans amp at some point. I was always very VT camp. I always used the VT series.
I was VT as well. I don't own a Sans amp currently, but I've had several VTs over the years that have done the trick for me.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't used one for... I don't remember the bass driver DI, like that, the one that you...
That was the original one, yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't have a mids. That's why I ended up with a VT. It didn't have a mids control, and I like punching mids.
The one I had was before there was the VT.
Right.
So, but yeah, I really like them, and like, I mean, like now I just use, I have different DIs that I use, like that Sonic Nuance one I've talked about before that I use. That's just, it's all about, like, for real DIs, it's all about like the transformer versus like the DIs you get with like sort of like effect boxes that are sort of there. So with tone control and with sort of, you know, like cab sim or something built in, but like, I mean, because that's really where, one, I mean, transformers are the biggest thing you're going to get. So, like, it's valves and transformers is really what the SVT is about. So if you can throw in, like, a big, hardy transformer with, like, a lot of iron or something in it and get, like, a Cinemag or a Lundahl or a Jensen or ones I really like, get something with one of those transformers in. This is also a... could go on the home recording episodes but like those transformers are, that's really where you're going to see like such a huge difference, I think. And then because there's so many things now that also do like a valve or tube front end that give you a lot of the breakup, or you get so many things like a tube preamp section that's really just there to sort of give you that little breakup that you kind of get, and it doesn't necessarily get you that like the sag feeling like when you're playing with like a fully valve head.
What do
you guys think about the like a Fender Bassman shout, like one of the 410?
I can't believe I missed that one out. The reintroduction of the Bassman and the Super Bassman, and then of course the Bassman 500 and the Bassman, which was their valve preamp, and the Bassman 100, which was their all valve 100 watt one. I felt like Fender sort of went, oh, hey, you know how everyone still really likes Ampegs, but Ampeg aren't really doing much at the moment? Should we just redo the Super Bassman heads more like them? Because they weren't really a lot like the old Bassman heads, the new ones they put out, not tonally. And I was a massive fan of the old Bassman 100 that could be used for guitar or bass. In fact, almost all the Polymath records are recorded on one of those, because they had one at Brighton Electric Studios where we'd record. Mm-hmm. But what an absolutely fantastic amp range by Fender. Like, I thought they were really good. I don't know. Have either of you actually spent much time with them, with the Bassman series?
not playing through. No, like tonally I've heard and studied others playing them, and like huge fan of the original models, but I don't know much about the current newer releases.
I actually automatically assumed that that was what you meant, JD, but did you mean the originals or the...
I think for this question we talk about the newer ones, right? Because it would be more like, what would you get sort of today, I think. If you come across like a vintage one that you could get for, you know, not multi-thousand pounds, then yeah, I would do it. But then, I think really it's that vintagey vibe, and it's really more, I mean, vintagey in a very straightforward way. Like they do what they do, right? Like you're not getting tons of bells and whistles, you're not getting like sends and returns, and you're not bi-amping, you're not, you know, it's like all this stuff you kind of see now, like get it. But I mean the more I think about it, the more I keep kind of coming back to like the idea of getting just you know, like one of the smaller lightweight heads and a Sans amp for, you know, for recording or for running that to the front of house, you know, like if you're, you know, when that's a thing again, you know, being able to sort of just do that. Cause that really gives you, I mean, Sans amp nailed it, you know, like when Tech 21 nailed it when they did that. Like it's such a big sound, and it's just right. Like it has one of those like special combination of things that shouldn't be special. That is just like, yep, that's it. That's you know, everyone should have one, and you should, you know, like if you're recording, you record one channel of that, one channel mic'd, and maybe, you know, like something else just in addition, you know, like it's such a useful tone that works with so much. Which I think is that SVT, like P-Bass, SVT, P-Bass, you know, like B-15, it's that sound. It's why that sound is on all records.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's true to the job of the bass fundamentally in a band setting, right? It's not, you know, it's not tonally affecting anything to the point where it begins to encroach on any other players or any vocal formants or anything like that, so...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a great thing, you know, on the note that Sans amps are such a dictionary definition of what of a replication of the SVT, I guess we have to talk about kind of the Helix series, whether that's the, you know, the Stomp, the LT, or the full bag, because of course Yamaha, who own Line 6, now own Ampeg.
They do.
And all of the Ampeg amps that are available on Helix, which is a B15, an SVT in either normal or a bright sort of configuration, plus there are a handful of others as well. I can't remember exactly which one. I think the 8, I think the 8 Pro is on there. But you know, those are faithful digital replications of the creme de la creme of Ampeg's, you know, catalog, available kind of on, you know, on the Helix. So those are all very, very good options as well. And why I've kind of, you know, really a big fan of the Helix. Funnily enough, as much as I am a big fan of the Helix, I actually prefer Boss's replication of the SVT on their GT1000 than I do Line 6 Helix. If I was going to pick one of the two units, I think a Helix is a better unit because you can do more with it. I think there's more fun and weird stuff, and I like fun and weird stuff. But the GT1000 for simple sound replication... if I was going to record a bass direct using one of those things, I'd use a GT1000. If I was going to make a load of weird ambient noise, I'd use a Helix, you know. But I think, yeah, both of those versions for digital replications, especially if you're going, you know, straight into a recording situation, they're very good indeed.
Absolutely. And that covers your physical space-taking, weighty product quandary as well.
Yeah.
You know, if you are a player without space or even without current band setup or anything like that, then it's that's kind of a decent solution.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, so I guess I just want to make sure we're sort of answering the question too, that it, you know, so it's like, because the question is like, how do we approach the amp side for less than 300? And I think, you know, I think it's, well, you, it depends on what part of the amp side it really is. Like, if it is going to the front of house, then there's that. But I mean, the other thing is, like, you put a Sans amp, you put that in front of sort of whatever else you're playing, and it, you know, like, if you put that in front of a Mark Bass head, you know, like, it will sound different than just sounding like a Mark Bass head. So that, you know, like, I think that's worth doing. And it sort of feels like, you know, finding whatever combination of features works for you and whatever sort of, you know, because in sort of all the Class D heads, you know, you get the 200 watt, the 500 watt, the 700 watt, because they all use the same power supplies, you know, like, it's, you know, like, it's, so it's sort of one of those things, you just find the right front end, whatever you want there, and just get something there. And again, not to, you know, really call this out, but like, I really, really like the Eden Terra Nova series. And
I thought they're the absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And I think there's something with them, because like, Eden has such a, from the World Tour series, and has such a reputation for being clinical, or being, you know, like, a really hi-fi sound, which it can be, but the Terra Nova is a very warm sounding Class D amplifier that that you can usually, you know, you can usually pick up, you know, pretty decently. And I think that's probably what I would do. But that's also because, like, I really like, again, like, that's just my own little issues with like SVT, and I really like the Bassman style stuff, but like, and that's what I use. If I use like an emulation somewhere, I usually tend to gravitate towards a Bassman more than I do an SVT. But I think that's also because I'm looking for something different than what I would play 80% of the time, which would be more like the Terra Nova series.
So. What wattage do the Terra Novas come in?
It's like 225 and 500, or right, roughly. And that's, yeah, like, with like cautiously rated RMS ratings, which is not worth going into. but yeah, so I mean, it's roughly that same sort of thing. So you could get the TN 226 model number, which is like the 250 watt, and that would, you know, that would basically cover your sub 300 watt, would go into any, you know, and even at somebody at that level has a speak on out, has, you know, a compressor built in, has, you know, deep switches, has, you know, parametric EQ on it, like,
yeah, that is super cool. I've always struggled with, I've never found anything 300 watts or lower that I've liked the sound of.
Yeah,
I don't think 300 watts deals with mids appropriately. I think I like really headroomy sounds.
Yeah,
and whilst that sort of 250, 300 watt mark tends to be the most affordable, I'm yet to listen to one, you know, a digital or solid state amplifier rated at sort of 250, 300 watts and go, oh yeah, this sounds good. I kind of find you need that 500 watts just to get that a slightly less compressed, fuller sound. But
what do you think about, so I mentioned this, but the Galleon Kruger, like the, even more the vintage stuff, I don't really know a lot of the new stuff that well, but like some of the lower watts, so not the 800 RBs or in the, you know, the 800 series, but like, you know, some of there's a few like 200-300 watts, that they used to do.
Well, they were kind of famous for that, the MB150, the 150 watt amplifier that was the size of a suitcase. And they were kind of the first brand ever to kind of be like, here is a tiny bass amp that you can gig with.
Yeah.
I specifically remember at the David Gilmour auction for all his guitars, he had one going up for auction. And I was like, yeah, if David Gilmour owned an MB150, then they were definitely awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on their website now. I wonder if they still actually do them, because they kind of fell into the new series of MB things.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah, because I know they have the 800, which I think is just their version class. I mean, I was just thinking about that because I was always. I never played them when I was sort of like before I had access to amps in the way that I do like now when I was kind of like they just weren't around like in the small town I was in, and I knew Fleet played one, and so I always thought they were cool, but I never played them until like later on in my life, and I knew they were all solid state, and I wanted, you know, like valves at some state, you know, like I had this mental block that I always wanted like tubes to be in my signal path. And then I never really played them. And then, they started showing up in like back lines and stuff. And then I ended up like trading for one, like some piece of gear, and had one. And I was surprised at how warm they were. And then certainly how reliable it was. And also just like, just how great it sounded anyway. And that it had built-in chorus, which was not my jam for chorus-wise, but, you know, like, it was just one of those, like, oh, there's chorus, and it's like, I can sound immediately, like, 80% of every, like, late or mid-80s to early 90s bass player who played a chord at any point during a song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those RB heads, I do think, are kind of legendary. And, yeah, of course, Flea, I think, still plays one, even though they're discontinued, according to their website. I think he played the RB 2000. What are they? How would you say that, JD? It's 2001, but how would that be in American? Is that the 2001?
I would probably say 2001.
Oh, like, right, okay.
It's such a big place. The rules are all over the shop. Like, it's, okay. Yeah, it's the 2001. Yeah, I think because there's 2001. Yeah, I mean, it's always their 800 series that, like, I think those are, like, the classic. Like, that's what you see at every back. Like, that's the you're renting this, you're getting a Gallian Cougar, not getting an SVT unless you pay for the SVT and,
yeah,
you know, the dental and, you know, chiropractic.
So. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they were good. Naomi, have you had much experience with GK?
With GK, I haven't had a huge amount outside of, really outside of backline that I've kind of had and got to use for the experience of a gig, and then that's kind of been it.
Those brands that's kind of appealed,
not,
I guess.
Not that it hasn't appealed, it has. I think I've kind of chased the more kind of SVT tones and gear over the years, and then more recently kind of got into Aguilar and EBS, so those were just kind of the ways my attention was drawn, I suppose.
Yeah,
but I don't think I've got to familiarize myself with the likes of the MB150 or anything like that outside of the newer models based on its legacy, really.
They're one of those brands, I think, along with maybe Hartke, that I think you could mm-hmm. throw in with Gallian Krueger, that kind of feels like maybe 15 years ago or so, they were just coming to the end of like their real heyday.
Sure.
I guess, yeah. Maybe at the time when Fender was starting to make bass amps again, Orange were moving into bass amps, Ashdown were really starting to come into their own, Mark Bass was, you know, turning
on
up, TC Electronic was turning up.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And those two brands sort of kind of fell away a little bit. I mean, I have a massive soft spot for Hartke. I think as a very big Billy Sheehan fan, I will always have a soft spot for Hartke, because I love that they managed to make incredibly affordable amps that are used by, you know, maybe the, I don't know, certainly one of the biggest, you know, bass players in the entire world. And he, you know, doesn't use Ampeg anymore. He uses Hartke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, admittedly, he uses them in a very clean capacity. And he has his Pierce preamps that actually he bought. They were, because they Pierce preamps went defunct, or went out of business. So he bought all of the Pierce preamps he could, but because they do eventually break, he was slowly getting through them. So he, last year or the year before, went to Line 6 and had Line 6 model his last Pierce preamp, or one of his last Pierce preamps. And so now he has a Helix going into his Hartke setup, very, you know, set up very clean. But, you know, I always thought it was super cool that he did that. And I loved the whole range of Hartke stuff. They kind of, it felt like they did something for everyone.
I really, the HA3500, that 350 watt head that they used to do, like I used to run multiples of those. And the thing that I always really, that was the one with the switchable in and out, like 10 band graphic EQ, because
yeah, I loved
mid-90s. And then I really liked they had the blendable preamp. So they had the tube preamp. And then they had the solid state preamp that you could blend on the front panel. And
no one's ever done anything like that. Yeah, it was genius.
And it worked well. Like, it was really nice. And it would, I really liked those heads. I mean, they were very utilitarian in a complimentary sense. Like, they were very straightforward and did what they did. And then, like, I wanted some more stuff from heads, which is why I ended up eventually moving away. But they were, I mean, for what you could get those for, like, I don't think anything touches them, you know. No. Like, I would happily grab one of those again.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they sit at price points, both new and used, kind of in the same way that Samson do in Pro Audio, where it's just this, you know, unsnobby, really well put together gear that doesn't want to make a fuss about itself.
Yeah absolutely.
Yeah, it's a good place to be.
Yeah, which is not something we talk about very often.
But I tell you what, I could do an entire episode on like Hartke's legacy, because, you know, they were the first people to do those like aluminium cone speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounded incredible in their HD series. Like, it was like they'd thought about what modern bass players wanted to sound like, and they made the perfect cone for it. And then at the same time, they were making their AK series of cabs, which were cotton wool lined.
Yeah.
And so they were made basically the same as the old SVT cabinets were made. And I love that, like, yeah, just at, like, at the same time, Hartke were doing, you know, a bit of both. Oh God, I really like Hartke stuff. I'm gonna have to buy a load of it.
Like,
I think.
I feel like we should do like very specific topical episodes at some stage, of just being like, we're only talking about history and, you know, like, affinity for Hartke this episode.
This episode brought to you by Hartke.
Yeah, we definitely should. Well, that does actually bring us up to time, pretty much, on this week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. How many questions did we manage to answer?
One.
Was that one
question? Which was exactly what I predicted.
Oh, yeah, that's... Okay. Okay.
The question episode.
I think we both owe JD a tenner now.
Yeah. That's why we kept talking about it. I was like, what do you guys think about GK?
Right. A valiant effort, JD.
Nice work. Wonderful. Well, it's 100% more questions than we've answered on the Guitar Nerds podcast over the last few weeks. So that's good. You know, we're doing well. But yes, you can of course, dear listener, catch us over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitarnerds, or you can follow Guitarnerds on any of the major social platforms with @guitarnerds, and we'll be back the week after next with more of this bass guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.